how can we create positive change? What does it mean to have an ecological mind?
How can interdisciplinary collaborations
help us move beyond educational silos and create sustainable futures?
Paola Spinozzi is professor of English literature at the University of Ferrara, where she also serves as pro vice chancellor for internationalization. She is the coordinator of the PhD program in environmental sustainability and well-being and the co-coordinator of the International University Network, Routes Towards Sustainability. Her research encompasses topics such as science and the visual arts, the ecological humanities, eco-criticism, cultural memory, utopia, and sustainability. She has co-edited the book Cultures of Sustainability and Well-being, Theories, Histories, and Policies.
Paola Spinozzi, welcome to the Creative Process in One Planet podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start with your journey. What drew you to the humanities and then to sustainability?
I am a literary scholar by training. So I started off as a scholar of literature and of English literature in particular. And then I realized that I didn't really like boundaries. So since the very beginning, I've always tried to explore other domains of knowledge, other areas. I started with the visual arts. So my first research has focused on the relationship between literature and the visual art. And in fact, my first publications are about that. I wrote a book about the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood and British symbolists. So in between writing and painting, in between poetry, novels, and illustration. And that has gone on for quite a number of years. Then it moved on to relationship between literature and science, because what has always fascinated me about science is the writing of science, how science is written, how science is circulated, how science is understood, how science is popularized, and more importantly, how science is narrativized. So what I did was with scholars and scientists, in order to focus on that, in order to focus on various degrees of specialization or non-specialization in the writing of the sciences. That is another very important, I would say, component of my research. And one has got to do with utopian studies. So that will lead me straight to sustainability. Utopian studies as in the ability to envision possible future societies in which, for example, the sciences and the humanities coexist and thrive on each other and sustain each other, and also the anxiety about futures in which instead totalitarianisms prevail. So utopian studies is actually what triggered my interest in sustainability. If you come and think of it, Mia, if you think about ideal societies or nightmarish societies, so the best possible futures, or they were possible futures, then after a while, you come to think about whether the future, whether futures may be sustainable or not, right? Whether we are able to support what we want, whether we are able to not only pursue and achieve, but more importantly, support what we want. So if I look back, I think that there is a common thread that originates from my desire to look into other perspectives, into other forms of research, and ultimately to try and envision futures, envision ways of living in the future that may be acceptable and above all enjoyable by possibly everyone. I know it sounds a bit too much because everyone is a very complicated word, but a world that can be as open and as diverse as possible.
Indeed. And it's so important because on the point of futures and the climate, usually climate scientists don't see themselves as storytellers, or they present it like an impartial view and they believe that the facts speak for themselves. But in fact, the facts don't speak for themselves. You have to speak for them. And that's why bridging people such as yourself and the humanities does that important work. Yes, not just to relate the facts, but also to imagine ourselves into other futures.
Yes, absolutely. That's very important. This is also what has stimulated me enormously. I had a range of friends and colleagues in different fields, life sciences, biosciences, medicine, chemistry, or more, I would say, soft sciences, political economists, social sciences, and some very deeply rooted ideas are about objectivity, about reliability, about also credibility. Of what is discovered. And there's also this bias whereby the humanities are all about the representation of the world, while the sciences are all about knowing the world, right? So the task of the sciences is to try and understand and know the world, while the humanities are entitled to and supposed to represent the world. But I've always believed that that is not the case, in the sense that the roles are in fact very deeply intertwined, that literature and the humanities and philosophy, history, the arts are ways of knowing the world and of course of representing the world, just like the sciences do. So the sciences cannot do without verbalizing. They cannot do without representing. You see, they do exactly the same. They understand the world in certain ways, and then they try to make sense of the world, and they try to communicate what they understand of the world, what they find about the world, in ways that are more or less understandable. So I think that what is really important is to try and put things together to bring people to talk to each other.
In your work on literature and science, you explore the narrativization of scientific theories. How do these narratives influence public perception and the environmental challenges? And how can literature serve as a powerful tool for communicating complex scientific concepts to a broader audience?
Thank you for this question. Well, I would say that it could be reduced to two main broad concepts. On the one hand, the idea that narrativizing the sciences and narrativizing what the sciences can tell us about the future can be exciting, uplifting, fascinating, or terrifying. You see, if you want to adopt this bipolar mode, then there are, of course, many other modes that are more intermediate. But there are these two poles, one of which is one of excitement about the possibilities, about the potential that scientific discoveries allow humans to achieve. And on the other hand, the anxiety about what can happen if anything goes wrong, also feeling that everything could possibly go wrong. So literary people, writers, artists, musicians, film directors have been able to foresee into the future. This is what they do from a creative point of view. And this has allowed the very wide and diverse audiences to try and identify with these different interpretations, with novels or poems that talk about anxiety, for example, about eco-anxiety, or that instead foresee a better future. I have to be honest with you that lately it's all about difficult, problematic technological futures more than a positive future.
Yeah, I'm of two minds about that. I mean, I think we actually have to face the difficult futures. You know, I'm an artist and I believe that the solace and the comfort that poetry can give, I think that's really important as we have to decide to make changes within our lives, that the place of the arts can help fill that gap, you know, as we commit ourselves to actually evolving our actions to take on climate change. But I do believe we have to face those difficult futures. You know, I had a conversation with David Fenton, who's been in this activist sphere for over 50 years. And I mean, it's a difficult truth to face, but he puts the story of climate change in a way that you can't avoid it. In fact, it's scientifically, you know, measured that the trapped heat energy on Earth is equivalent to 1 million atomic bombs going off every single day. And when you face a kind of statistic like that, it's hard not to have eco-anxiety.
I do totally agree not to invest in the future generation. It's very important that we do that. And this is why I have built up a PhD program in environmental sustainability and well-being. It took me almost 2 years to do that. So I started thinking about that project in 2018. And then it was launched in November 2019. It's been very tough because people have developed different tools. You're an artist. I'm a literary person. If we want to talk about, you see, specificities, and someone is an economist, someone else is a scientist or a physicist or a physician, it's very difficult to talk about similar topics when your backgrounds are so different. There's a lot of suspicion, caution, also almost indifference, as in, why should I want to talk to you? Why should I want to work with you? Why should I want to train someone with, right? So these are the kinds of obstacles, or rather issues, that I've had to cope with. And it took me a long time to come up with a group of people that would really want to commit themselves to that project. Precisely because the question was, what is there in it for me as a biologist, as an ecologist, as a sociologist, as a professor of art history? You see, but then after a number of years, I can say that things have changed. And above all, what has changed is our minds and the minds of these young scholars and scientists. I would like to give an example. We have a young chemist who defended his thesis back in June, and he was very hardwired. He was very difficult to approach. I remember when I met him 4 years ago, he said, okay, I'm a student. I understand that this is an interdisciplinary PhD program, but I'm a chemist. I'm a chemist through and through. So I need to process data and I need to stick to the hard facts. Well, to make it a long story short, after 4 years, now, what has he become? A popularizer of science. He has decided to teach. He's decided to build up programs that are based on chemistry and specifically on environmental chemistry, soil chemistry. Programs that he can offer to various schools and to various categories of schools, secondary schools, primary schools. So this still very young scientist who identified a few years ago as the hard chemist has changed his mind. I'm not saying that he has become someone else, but that his mind has changed in the sense that he has been able to incorporate and to absorb and to filter various forms of knowledge and above all various forms of communication. He's come to understand that is what really matters to him. Being in a lab on his own, processing data and publishing is still important, but what really matters to him is to be able to communicate environmental awareness, environmental understanding through his own knowledge that has become an interdisciplinary knowledge.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I've faced that myself. We had a lot of attendance in our exhibitions, and our inaugural exhibition at the Sorbonne had over 40,000 visitors, which is a good showing for an exhibition. But with our podcast, because we're lucky, we get more than that in a day, you know? So it's just reaching different people in different parts of the world. So you have to ask yourself, how can you escape these silos of knowledge, and how can you reach people wherever they are so that they can take it further down the road?
Yes. Also, to go back to what we said at the beginning, the silos are still there. They are galore. But I also think that what is important is that younger scholars and scientists, the next generation of scholars and scientists, come up with different ideas, as well as more senior scholars and scientists understand that they can still change, but for the better, that they can still incorporate other views, other perspectives, because that, in a sense, is even more difficult, right? For someone in their 40s, 50s, or 60s, it is more difficult to try and acquire other tools, other perspectives. But at the same time, if you are exposed to a certain environment that is just intrinsically, just quintessentially interdisciplinary, you end up doing that spontaneously. This is what I feel is very important, to try and provide a truly interdisciplinary, a truly intercultural, interdisciplinary, interdepartmental. We can use inter in many cases. But if you are able to create that kind of environment, those kinds of environment, then everything comes easy. You don't have to struggle.
Yes, and I'm also interested in that you have as well an architectural program. And just tell us, you know, about some of those collaborations there.
Yes, with the architects, we have been working in many interesting ways, because clearly when we talk about sustainability, we talk about architecture. In fact, it was architecture at the very beginning that sort of claimed that sustainability was their true calling. I remember just 10 years ago, architects thought that they would be the ones entitled more than anyone else to talk about sustainability, which is certainly the case. So what is important with architects and also with urban planners is that they are able to read different kinds of environment, urban environment, green environment, and above all, they are able to read intermediate environments which are characterized by different typologies. And they're able to think in terms of materials, in terms of networks, in terms of mobility, which is fundamental because mobility is connected to our well-being, but also to the well-being of the environment. And they've also been able to collaborate with medics. I had one project in particular that has been carried out by a PhD student. It's one that's got to do with patients with a kidney condition that need constant dialysis. And what architects have done has been to introduce new environments in the hospital. And this has been particularly difficult because hospital buildings have been made in order to comply with certain rules and regulations. So you cannot simply change the atmosphere, the setup of the room. Now they have had to change the protocols. So this particular section of the building that has these kinds of patients that have to go there regularly has really changed completely in order to welcome them and not make them feel it is terrible to be there on a regular basis, but they can be there and enjoy a much more humane and a much more soothing environment, exactly through this idea of introducing different colors, light, and so just to give an example of how it can work, architects doing their thing or architects collaborating with others.
And of course, it's also been proven that this kind of thing and meditation, the mind influences the body, influences the mind. It's all of a piece. So it's hugely important for that recovery process as well. And of course, we know, talking about sustainability, that huge advances in decarbonization can be made by adapting hospital systems. And I know that quite a few hospital systems have signed on for this. It's difficult because there's so many things that can't be recycled in hospitals. But speaking about architects and designing a better future, we're living in the center of the city. We are living in a decade of transformation. We hear a lot about creating smart cities, smart buildings, but many people living in cities have no idea where their future is going. You know, so when it comes to, as you reflect on housing and transport and climate and education, I know heat waves and storm surges, what are your reflections on what the cities of the future will look like?
Well, different parts of the world have very different setups. We can think about Europe and difficulties that we face in Europe, but also places in Asia and in America. For example, I can quote the famous Manila gridlock is something that is quite well known. But now Manila is moving towards alternative or complementary form of mobility that try to introduce dedicated paths for people who want to walk, people who want to cycle. And the same can be said for citizens in Brazil. I'm thinking about Sao Paulo. I'm thinking about Rio. I'm thinking about a town I'm very familiar with. It's called Curitiba. It's less famous than others, but it's been one of the first cities to experiment with a new form of mobility, special buses on elevated platforms that put the users on a special level. You see, it allows them to be safe and secure when they get on the bus or when they get off the bus. And the same has been done in Jakarta and in Bogota. So I'm talking about examples of enormous cities in which clearly the problem of mobility is at the foreground. But I'm also talking about cities that have tried to introduce alternative forms of mobility. The Millennium Bus that was introduced in Bogota and I tried it, and also being introduced in Jakarta with problems. Again, there are buses that run on dedicated lanes. They require dedicated platforms for passengers to access the bus. So they require reorganizing. So I'm very much in favor of adaptation, of finding ways of adapting the city to new forms of mobility and of transport. This is what I think could be a solution.
And you're at the University of Ferrara, and I don't know the adaptation that Ferrara is undergoing at the moment. We're lucky in these European cities in some way that everything is locally arranged.
Yes. Ferrara is very peculiar. It's a town. I wasn't born in Ferrara, so maybe it's easier for me to see the strength and the weaknesses. So one of the main strengths is that it is a World Heritage Site, thanks to its very well-preserved walls and gates. So it is a Renaissance town, an early modern town, that like other towns in Italy, I'm thinking about Urbino, for example, have been very well preserved. So you can see how they look like in the Middle Ages, and you can see the transition of these towns from the Middle Ages to the early modern age. So Ferrara does that to you. When you visit Ferrara, you have a very clear idea of how the town has developed, also because of its size. It's a medium-sized town. And it has two very distinctive parts. The medieval part, it's all a maze, and the Jewish ghetto that looks like a maze, and it's very picturesque. And then it's got the early modern part of the town that is called Addition, because just the family in the early modern age, I'm talking about 15th to 16th century, they reorganized the town. They added, this is what's called addition, they added a new part to the town that is very well organized. And that has been subjected to urban planning. So you have two, again, almost bipolar aspects. One of them is totally loose and more mysterious. You've got little alleys, you've got cobblestones, and the other with bigger roads and more geometrical shapes. So that is as far as the town is concerned and its strength. Its weaknesses is that it is so self-contained that it ends up being self-enclosed. You see, I was born in a seaside town, Rimini. So when you're born by the sea, you really always go back to the sea. The sea becomes structural. So the fact that Ferrara is landlocked, you can really enjoy Ferrara if you like being in Ferrara, because as I said, it is self-enclosed. But to me, a little bit too much in some respects.
Yes, I'm drawn to the sea as well. It is a wonderful point of reflection. So now, shooting forward to your interest in post-apocalyptic literature and climate change fiction, what insights can literature offer in understanding humanity's relationship with the environment during times of crisis?
Thank you. This is an amazing question. I was recently at a conference in Poland. I was invited by colleagues. They organized a conference on the apocalypse. So I went there and I talked about different forms of the apocalypse, which I've studied for a long time, but I decided to do something different, decided to come up with a few conceptual models. And I think that an interesting point of reflection is the fact that the apocalypse over the last decade has moved in different directions. It is no longer and not only the end of the world as we know it. It's no longer and only the doom that, as we know, exists in many cultures. Most all cultures have this idea that at some point the world will end. And this could be the terminus, could be the ultimate end, or it could be an opportunity for a new beginning. And then we call it palingenesis. It's a new beginning. So that still stands. But what has changed in the collective imagery is that the apocalypse is no longer just in the future, but it has become a time travel apocalypse in the sense that it has moved in between different timelines from the future to the past to another future to a different past. So it has become a more vast concept instead of being a fixed concept, one that in a sense introduces the end. It has become rather a concept that allows us to move between different forms of future and different forms of past, because you can always rewrite the past, not only the future, but also the past, if the past you go back to is not the same, but it's a parallel past or is an alternative past. You see, it's connected to the idea of alternative history of Ukraine. And this has been very much the case with the latest novels and also the latest TV series. I'm thinking about, for example, The Umbrella Academy. So the apocalypse happens many times because you go back and then it happens. And again, if you go forward, but it's another timeline. So that event in the past has changed the future. So it bifurcates or it goes in all directions. Or think about another splendid, for me, movie, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Got the same idea, right? So the apocalypse is still connected to fear and this idea of an impending doom, but it's also nurtured by the idea that it's not the ultimate end, but it is rather one among many possible ends and simultaneously one among many possible new beginnings.
Yes, the multiverse. And this came after your concentration on utopian studies and the Pre-Raphaelite period. Tell us about the counter side of that coin, you know, those touchstone works for you that represent utopian aesthetics.
Thank you also for this question. Well, I will have to focus on British literature because, as you know, it's my first literature of choice. But starting from that, I would mention Thomas More's Utopia, that was written in Latin. So we always refer to an English title that was translated, but in fact, it's not in English. And then the other is News from Nowhere, from William Morris, that was written around 1881, 1882. And along with that, I would also mention and quote an Italian text, La Città del Sole, The City of the Sun, by Tommaso Campanella, a priest. So the three of them envision a future society, and this society of the future, well, for more, it's not necessarily in the future, but it is somewhere else. But these ideal alternative societies are ideal societies. And there's a lot that we can find exciting about authors that want to foresee ideal societies. But at the same time, there's also something scary, because the question is, ideal for whom, right? And it's almost inevitable when we read these three texts that belong to the classical utopian tradition, written by male authors. I could quote female authors, but I want to use those three canonical male authors for a reason. So they come up with very fine, very innovative, original, and experimental ideal societies. But the problem cannot be solved. They are good. They are utopian for whom? Certainly not for everybody. There's always someone who is left out. For Thomas More's Utopia, it's all about communitarianism. For Campanella, it's all about the ability to blend, to bring together Christianity and Neoplatonism. There's very ascetic, transcendental life and way of living according to very lofty principles. While William Morris is, to me, fundamental because he's the last utopian thinker and writer. After William Morris, it is very rare to find another utopia. He wrote at the end of the 19th century, and after him, it's almost impossible, if not totally impossible, to find utopian societies. And in News from Nowhere, he thinks of a future London. He doesn't say exactly when this London will happen. He describes London also from an architectural point of view, one in which egalitarianism has been achieved, and more importantly, one in which human beings are able to do what suits them. And it is just a spontaneous way of doing things. Nobody's forced to do anything, but everybody is able to make the most of their potential precisely because they are left free to decide what they want to do. So I love the optimism in this view. I love also the idea of equality between genders. I love the idea of a green utopian, a green ecological utopia that has been pointed out. It is interesting to notice that over the last 10 years, News from Nowhere, that is a very important text, has been read more in ecological terms. So now Morris is regarded as one of the fathers of ecological thinking. But I think there's a lot of truth in that, because he wanted to think of an alternative to Victorian London and Victorian industrialization. So these three texts for me are very, very important. If I may quote a fourth and last one, that would be Doris Lessing. Doris Lessing, that is a very important utopian thinker in her own right. She wrote Mare and Dan, a truly utopian or dystopian climate fiction, in fact. So we could actually define, classify that text as very good examples of climate fiction. But I would like to think about Doris Lessing more in terms of an author that always been very sensitive to diversity. And I'm thinking about African Stories, in which she goes back to her childhood memory and memories in the plural to talk about Zimbabwe, where she was raised, and the clash between her readings as an English girl that would read about the Lady of Shalott or British romance and King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, an environment that was completely different. Couldn't have been more different. So she looked out of the window and she saw the savannah. And she read and she saw the lakes and the moats in medieval England. So I think Doris Lessing also is an amazing inspirational author.
Reflecting on Paola Spinozzi and Doris Lessing, I'm interested in the tacit self-erasure underpinning desires for utopias that don't just exclude individuals who share Lessing's background, but specifically identify themselves as utopias by negating any kind of continuity with those individuals. This brought to mind Jean Rhys's Wide Sargasso Sea, the way she imagines a narrative for Charlotte Bronte's Bertha Mason in Jane Eyre that retroactively revolts against the expressive impoverishment assigned to Caribbean characters in Victorian novels, and signals a dynamic strife between ways of imagining cultures, histories, and possible worlds. The Sargasso Sea is a gyre that quite literally emerges out of the tensions produced by four ocean currents, each of them bordering a continent historically involved in the triangular trade. And for Rhys, it symbolizes how the diffuse echoes of power, empire, and violence engender on one end what it means to live in the Caribbean, but also obscure it, or prevent us from grasping it outside of the triangular structure that relegates the region to a colonial commodity. Cuba, where my mother's family is from, has a similar history of trading hands between Europe and the Americas, and turning and turning in an ever-constricting gyre of tensions that lap up the island like a sea foam. It's a place that I feel has always struggled to decide who it is and who it wants to be. And now, this struggle, rather than depositing it in a Hegelian fashion at the golden end state, seems to have left it in a vibrating entropic condition, a condition of survival but no mobility. The Cuban poet Virgilio Piñera touches upon this anxious, paralytic lack of mobility when he writes, "The curse of being completely surrounded by water condemns me to this coffee table. If I didn't think that water encircled me like a cancer, I'd sleep in peace." Given this, Victorian England, with its illusion of coherence and self-enclosure, feels like an irresistible utopia. And yet, by reaching into the gyre and pulling out Jamaica, Rhys disturbs the utopian image. She shows us that its coherence, like Bronte's novel, is really just a fiction adopted to legitimize an exceptionalist self-understanding. Through Paula Spinosi's comments, I've come to realize that maybe utopia appeals to our past just as much as our future. Not just a past where things may have been different, but a new way of thinking about it in our shared human history. And now, back to the interview.
So you mentioned utopias written about during the start of the industrial times, and now the AI revolution is truly underway. We've seen exponential development even in the last few months. So people are saying that there's possibilities about being free from work. Some of these same issues recurring and how we will work with our AI co-creators. It's creating a lot of anxiety because where will we get our sense of meaning and self-worth if we no longer have to work? You know, some people posit that there could be greater, as you say, wealth distributed in this new automated society, but it's definitely going to change all aspects, including education. So what are your reflections on the future of work and the future of education?
Another important question. You know, we talk about decarbonizing the future, and one of the main challenges is to come up with policies that cannot be thought in a top-down way. It is not thinkable that millions of workers are left out of the process because, of course, we have to think about all the stakeholders, starting from the workers. And then when it comes to education, for me, what is fundamental is that education encompasses more environmental education and along with environmental communication to communicate what is happening to the environment and what we can do to save the environment. So for me, education requires rethinking about the school system, starting with elementary school. Children at the age of 5, they should already attend schools in which environmental communication, environmental understanding are at the core of their syllabus. So I think that children, they have to develop tools from very, very early on.
Yes. And what are your reflections on the opportunities and challenges of AI and the new technologies?
I want to quote a poem rethought by and revisited by a conceptual artist. The poem I'm talking about is a long title. It's called All Washed Over by Machines of Loving Grace. So this originally is a 1967 poem by an American author, Richard Brautigan. But then in 2021, it became a video by a Turkish artist. The name is Memoz Akpin. So it's a video and it is available. You just search for the title of the poem and you will see this video that brings together, well, of course, the poem, but an amazing array of images in which you see different natural environments and artificial intelligence. So gradually they come to blend and then they meld and then they become one, which is a bit, of course, disconcerting because as you can imagine, as an artist, the colors and shapes of nature are all bright. They are greens and blues. And the shapes are natural, while the colors of artificial intelligence are much more metallic and the lines are geometrical. So they come together in this very strange concoction. But it's an interesting video. So you hear the poem and you see this future world in which apparently and hopefully nature and AI can coexist. And I just want to quote some of the lines. I like to think it has to be of a cybernetic ecology, where we are free of our labors, enjoying back to nature, return to our mammal brothers and sisters, and all watched over by machines of loving grace.
Yes, and as we consider possible futures, of course, climate education, it's key. And also adaptive intelligence, because we're talking about the humanities. People think that's an optional extra, but what are you going to do situationally? And I think that once people have a perspective that they have real solutions and just don't get these doomsday statistics, then their sense of well-being, as you know from your institute, increases, and then they can act effectively and they're not paralyzed by a future that they feel they have no stake in.
Also, when we talked about cities, if I have to think about Italy, it's not only about cities, it's about regions. Italy is a country made up of regions. So you think in regional terms, also you think about Italy in Europe, and you have to think about the terrible dividing that we had between North and South. So someone who lives in a very rich and privileged region, Emilia-Romagna, so the north center, but things change gradually and then dramatically if you go south. So when we talk about how to adapt to the future, well, how we adapt to the future is very different. And we think about Sicily, Puglia, where we have the most breathtaking landscapes and seascapes in Italy, but very difficult issues when it comes to infrastructures, when it comes to policies, when it comes to government, and when it comes to the relationship between those regions and the central government. So that is another very important challenge, to be able to diversify, which is clearly very difficult because humans tend to homogenize, right? They tend to reduce everything, to simplify everything. Instead, we have to think about as many different options as possible and keep them together.
And what are some of those more equitable solutions that covers all of Italy?
Well, I think that it really depends on being able to train truly ecological minds. And by that, I mean minds that are able to encompass different aspects. So economists have received a training in economy, but have acquired perspectives in the social sciences, in the humanities, in the life sciences. So to go back to what we said at the beginning, they're no longer constrained, they're no longer limited to ways of thinking that one attaches to that specific discipline or that specific domain of knowledge. An ecological mind is one that has been able to stretch. You see, it's been able to think about other problems. For example, as a literary scholar, you're able to read texts, so you're able to interpret texts. Yes, absolutely. But it, by being able to interpret texts that talk about the climate, talk about the cultural climate, they talk about the environment, if by doing that, I'm able to talk to people, I'm able to make people aware, I'm able to make people want to read more, want to say more. If poetry or literature, both the theater or the art, are able to empower people, then you see it goes well beyond one's own specificity.
Of course, you are a lead organizer of the European Conference for the Humanities with Silvana Colella. Tell us a little bit about that and the importance of the humanities.
Yeah, absolutely. She was the one who invited me. She was the one who encouraged me to organize this conference. So I'm very grateful to her. I chose a difficult term, mindedness, a bit of a mouthful. And I thought long and hard whether I wanted to use that title because it's a bit long and heavy. But I think that sometimes heaviness is important, and above all attached to ecological mindedness. You see so many syllables. But ecological mindedness goes along with ecological minds. So to be able to develop an ecological mind starts from being ecological mindful and ecological minded. So it's about really understanding what it means to be interdependent, what it means to be interconnected. So that brings together all the species, every kind of species we can think of. It has to really filter very slowly in order to be metabolized, because it takes time. We all think that we understand nature when we are in a natural environment. We all feel energized, we all feel excited, and we all feel uplifted, right? But then how long does it last? And what does it do? What do we do with it? To me, ecological mindedness, the topic of ISHIC, is exactly this: being committed, developing a commitment towards the environment and towards well-being. And with well-being, I mean the well-being of all species. It cannot be the well-being of some species and not of others. Because it's not just altruistic, it's also, in a sense, instrumental, right? It's only when we are really interdependent that we can thrive and we can continue. So this was the core of this conference. From various perspectives, we had mainly, of course, humanities scholars in a very broad sense, but also people from other sectors. And I think that it has attempted to foster an interdisciplinary dialogue.
Yes. And so as you think about the future and education, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I would want people of the future to be able to preserve cultural memories, memories of how cultures, their own cultures, and all the cultures that they will encounter in their lives have come to be, how they have developed, how they have interacted with other culture, how they have clashed with other culture. So I think of culture in very broad terms, but above all, I think of memory. I think that memory is fundamental for each and every one of us, regardless of our main area of interest or expression. I think that memory is what allows us to not fall into gaps, not fall into the abyss of oblivion, misunderstanding. And it takes a lot of energy to preserve cultural memories. So it's a huge effort in that respect.
Paola Spinozzi, thank you so much for your passion and commitment and humanistic principles, for sharing your cultural memories, reflections on the importance of the humanities to face our present, imagine possible futures, and provide a broader historical and transdisciplinary perspective on sustainability. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you so much, Mia. I hope there is another opportunity to talk again because I've enjoyed this immensely. Thank you so much for having me.
The One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sam Myers and Virginia Moschetti. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you enjoyed this program. If you would like to get involved in the One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.